Solomon. I'm from Emory University, the Center of Research and Social Change from Atlanta, Georgia. I'm here in Washington, D.C. at the International Liberators Conference, interviewing a very unique group of men. I would like to identify each. On my extreme right, we have Father Dr. Edward Doyle. Next is Mr. James Livesay. Did I pronounce
Livesay.
It correctly? Livesay.
Livesay.
Is that correct? Livesay.
That's right.
Thank you. And next is Rabbi Gunter Plaut. These three gentlemen were all involved in the liberation of the Nordhausen concentration camps. And we're going to hear a unique combination of experiences about the camp, but not only about the camp, but about a reunion between two of the gentlemen here, Father Doyle and Rabbi Plaut, who saw each other here at this Liberators Conference for the first time again in 35 years. And I was privileged to be a witness that get-together. First, I need to ask each of you a few questions for the record, and we'll start with you, Father Doyle.
Yes.
Where are you from?
I'm from Providence, Rhode Island.
Okay. And your date of birth?
My goodness. June 30th, 1907.
Okay. And your age at the time of liberation?
Well, I'd have to do a little subtracting, as we're adding, if
okay.
you will.
Okay. We'll
I would
for
say
that.
It was about 35, 36 years of age. 35.
Your prospective profession at the beginning of the war? Were you
I was teaching in Providence College at the time. Afterwards, Pearl Harbor came, and then I asked for permission to go in the service, and it was granted eventually. And then I became a member of the 104th, the Timberwolf Division, which was the division that had freed Nordhausen.
You were part of
it? I was a Catholic chaplain in the division, 104th Division, yes.
And you are still practicing as a Catholic chaplain?
Oh, yes, yes. Well, I'm not in the service anymore, of course.
Right.
I am now taking care of a medical center since I have left teaching 3 years ago.
I'm
a retired teacher.
Uh-huh. Yeah. And you did mention your military unit. Would you repeat that for us again?
Yes, it was the 104th Timberwolf Division.
Timberwolf Division.
It's called Timberwolf because that is the state animal of the state of Oregon. You might recall the 104th, that means that anything over 100, as I understand it, means it's a National Guard unit, and they're mobilized. Below 100 would be regular army.
I see.
So that has origin in Michigan, or rather in Oregon, as a result of which it has timber wolf as the animal.
I appreciate that explanation because I haven't heard it before.
Yeah.
Thank you very much.
Yeah.
Mr. Livesay, I have
Livesay.
The same. Livesay, I don't think I'll get that name correct. Livesay, I have these same questions for you. Where are you from, Mr.
Richmond, Virginia.
Richmond. And your date of birth?
July the 16th, 1924.
And your age at the time of liberation?
20.
20 years. And what was your perspective, profession, at the beginning of the war?
I was a railroad telegraph operator and an agent.
And your present occupations?
I'm retired.
Okay. And your military unit at the time?
I was in A Company, 413th Infantry Regiment, 104th Division, Timberwolf Division.
And your rank at the time of liberation?
PFC.
I neglected to ask you your rank, Father.
I'm a major, but
you
I was,
the
I was
major
a captain at
that
time, yeah.
Captain at the time, okay. And it's your turn, Rabbi Plaut.
Was born November 1st, 1912. And unlike these two gentlemen, I was born in the United States. I was born in Germany. So I was really returning to the land of my birth. And I had a terrible time getting into the army. Because
but you didn't give us your date of birth.
I did too. You're not listening.
1912. But what was the date of that?
November 1st.
Was the 1st. I'm
yeah,
sorry. I heard the 1912, but I didn't hear the date.
Yes, that's Sunday.
Okay, thank you. That
anyway,
was
I was just about 33 at the time of liberation.
Uh-huh.
I said I had a terrible time getting into the army because being from Germany, I was at first an enemy alien. But when I finally was naturalized, on the day afterwards, I enlisted, and it was my good fortune to get to know Father Doyle in those days. And whatever little salvation we could bring to the men of the 104th was due to the Protestant chaplain.
Where is he? That here.
All right, we're going to go right to the camp in our questioning now. When you got to the camp and you gentlemen can answer in turn if you wish. Father, what did you see?
First of all, the medics, of course, were the first ones on the scene, and then the call went out that they needed more medical personnel. And since it was my wont to be at the medical center when the call came in, I followed the medics there. So on my scene, when I went with the medics to see her, and I arrived at the time when they were bringing out the bodies and just trying to make order out of a tremendous chaos. It was an overwhelming sight, as you've heard many times descriptively. Of the 6,000 we liberated, political prisoners, 5,000 of whom were emaciated corpses, you know, beaten, starved, mutilated, and might say here now, of course, just skeletons with skin on them. So there were 5,000. And of the 1,000 more or less were living, they had to be taken care of immediately. So the living was our first concern, whereby you find walking ambulatory and others who had to be litters. And I think we may bring out later on that we commandeered the men of the village, the old German men, to come and carry litters. And they had makeshift, whereby a piece of carpet or maybe a doa or a sheet to assist in the burial of these 5,000 bodies. But first of all, we took care of the living.
So that, and that you remember as your first sight, as
very
the
much
people
so.
Of the camp.
And men, women, and I said, particularly one child, particularly in my mind of the day, a bloated child, I don't recall. But there were men, women, and children there.
And your memories?
Similar to Father Doyle's, I was ordered to go to the camp to assist in the medical people in taking care of the living first, and then the dying and the dead. And I had a similar experience with seeing these particular corpses in all states of disarray, of course.
What was your reaction to what you saw? You saw a lot of death during the war.
Yes.
You saw buddies being killed.
Yes.
Was that death a different type of death than the death you saw
yes.
at Nordhausen?
I don't know whether you can explain it in a way, but my stomach turned on me. In other words, I had a gut reaction, and I became literally ill. But of course, I had to go on and do what I was supposed to do, as he did and all the others.
Did you go in there with some other men, or were you by yourself at the time that you...
No, I went in with some other men.
Did they have a similar reaction that you were...
I think so, yes.
And your experience?
Well, I would like to hook onto what Jimmy has said. I think until that morning, which was also the same day that Roosevelt died in the United States, but we didn't know it as yet.
We're talking about April 13th.
April 12th.
1945.
We got to the camp on the 11th, but we didn't go in until the 12th. I think until that morning, many of the 14,000 men in our division didn't really fully understand what the war was all about. They, I don't know what the two of you remember, but I remember a lot of things about that. Of course, for me, it was a very special environment. It was not too far from where I was born. Mm-hmm. And I was also in a little different position from both of you, because on my Jeep there was a big chaplain's flag with a Jewish star, and so many of the people that were still alive were Jews, and the idea that a person with a Jewish star should come freely into the camp rather than being
part of them
was almost incomprehensible. And they came up just to touch me, That when people came up and kissed my feet, I mean, it's the most humiliating thing to me that there should be human beings who would put me in a position which I most certainly didn't deserve. At any rate, when we were finally there and saw this, what Jim says is so right. I saw many of our men vomit at what they saw. And now I want to talk about the aspect of burial, which after the day or two was our next consideration, because you could not let 4,000 corpses lie around unburied in the warm spring sun.
Were you given orders for burial?
No, I don't. We just.
The decision you were making.
Well, I don't know. That was natural.
We were told General Eisenhower had said that all of the bodies should be buried. They should have a decent.
And
burial.
Eisenhower made a brief visit.
Yes.
And he didn't believe what he saw. Now, we commandeered burghers, the citizens of Nordhausen.
Right,
and since the majority of the people to be buried were Jews, I had a very special task. And we asked them, if you remember, Ed, we asked them to dress in their Sunday best, because after all, they're coming for a funeral. They didn't know what they were supposed to do. Mm-hmm. And also please to supply us with spades, but if they didn't have spades, spoons would do. And so they came, and then they were asked to move the dead, but they said, not the way I'm dressed. This was their main concern at that moment. And they didn't want to believe what they say, and to the last man and woman, because women participated in this, they said, we knew nothing about it.
That's
when the
true.
Stench was so awful,
the town,
and the whole town was only a few kilometers from where we are, but we asked them to bury the dead with their own hands.
How was this mobilized? When you're talking about a group of burghers, many German citizens.
Yeah.
Was there an official there that was mobilizing this group
to come
in for
the
burial?
The burgomaster had fled, I believe, for Nordhausen, but his deputy was commandeered. And they say approximately 100 elderly gentlemen who were not war. Soldiers were brought in from the village, you see.
Uh-huh.
And there was about 100 older gentlemen who.
Yeah, but also some women.
Yeah, I don't recall that.
And women.
See, 36 years makes you a little vague on some little things.
Certainly. That's why the sharing of this
that
memory.
That is your advanced age.
I don't want to mention it. Factual.
You can tell we have friends here on the panel. Were there any children?
Yes.
In this group?
There were a few children.
In the citizens of the.
I don't recall the children, but Ed
does.
I recall children as victims,
yes.
But no, I wouldn't say, that's a little vague in my mind. I think not. I think that they probably, sheltered them from it.
Mm-hmm. But we have one picture that I saw taken by one of our men. I have the book that I was given the book today. I didn't know it was in existence. Where a mother, all dressed up, is standing with her two sons, both teenagers, one perhaps 11, 12, and the other one maybe 13, 14, standing there looking at this, and she's putting one hand over the younger child's eyes so that he should not have to see it.
So I would say that would be there. There'd be no children involved in the cortege for the funeral.
No, we didn't ask the children to bury them.
No.
Right.
Incidentally, amongst the liberated, if I may say this, unbeknownst to me, but since that time, I found this out, was a young woman by the name of Lily Meyer.
Uh-huh.
She was at the time, she was taken by the American troops into the hospital nearby where German soldiers were ordinarily cared for. And there on the table next to her in that hospital, she found something lying there, and she took it and she opened it, and it was a picture album of photographs taken by a German officer in Auschwitz at the selection process, as Mengele said, to death and to life. And as she opened this, she fainted, because these were pictures of herself and her family. By accident, this picture album had caught her and her family as they got off the train. And she kept this album, and recently she gave it to the Yad Vashem in Jerusalem. And when I read the story in the newspaper, I went to Miami to seek her out, because our paths crossed, even though she didn't know I was there and I didn't know she was there.
It's an incredible story.
It certainly is.
But there was another story that you mentioned before when I met you in the hallway about a Torah. That was somebody.
Yes, that involved a Roman Catholic priest in the little town of Brunt, which is a suburb of Aachen, El Chapelle, where our division was located in November, December, before the Bulge, before the Battle of the Bulge. Remember, Brunt? I don't know, maybe your unit was another. I was with Signal Corps at the time. You were with the medics, I was with Signal Corps, because we had to be attached someplace. And the priest came after he found out that there was a Jewish chaplain in the division, a rabbi. And he came and said, I have something that I want to give you. And he had with him two scrolls about this size and fragments, torn fragments. And he said, these I rescued in the street on the night of November 9th and 10th when they burned the synagogue.
Yeah.
And I knew that this was God's word and I could not see it lie in the street. And so and he had hidden it, because had he been discovered with it, there might have been a severe reprimand or worse. So the man risked a possible retribution from the Nazis by just holding on to the scroll. But and I think, I forget the details now, he buried it or hid it. At any rate, he brought it, and I thanked him profusely. He told me some of the details. And after he had gone, I unfolded the scroll, and where it had just been torn by the Nazis. Yeah. I unfolded it, and where was it accidentally torn? Where had the Nazis torn it? Right where the Ten Commandments were. That's where they had torn it.
Yeah.
But of course they didn't know.
No.
That's quite a
story.
An experience, which gets us really to the next question about religion. We have two men of the cloth here, and you show professionally, obviously, you had a belief in God. Was that belief ever challenged at the time of this experience? Father, would you like
to? I'm going to say, for instance, tonight, when I'm going to give an invocation tonight at the banquet at the Smithsonian Institute, I'm going to say that the Holocaust was the tragic failure of man. So it isn't God who failed, it's man who failed. So that I think, again, that we see the, and to me, we're postulate a greater need for God. We need God more than ever. This can happen, man. As I mentioned also, too, there are more vices than virtue. The virtues could be enumerated, so to speak, or some, you know, justice, and so to speak, but the vices are multiple, because man has that demonic aspect within him, and therefore I would say this, to my mind, didn't jeopardize my faith, but it indicated to me that we have greater work to do, because man has failed, not God.
So you were inspired to prove that man has failed God.
These whole ceremonies have stimulated me to be more aware of the need of God, and because of man's possibilities for vice and for failure.
And Mr. Livesey, did you have any religious reactions? Or
there is a saying that there's no atheist in the foxhole, and that's very true. in this particular situation, I called upon God to give me strength to go on and do what I was supposed to do. So, since that time, I haven't questioned God, because we don't know what his plans are for us.
Rabbi, did you have any feelings?
I wish that I could answer the questions quite that simply, but I can't. I would say that my faith was very severely tried at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And I asked questions that we sometimes don't like to ask. But ever since that time, I've wrestled with it, and I became not only a historian, but a theologian as well, and I've written extensively about it. I arrived at a different conception of God at the end of this search. I can't let God off quite that easily and put it all on man. And that is not meant to be disrespectful or irreverent, far be it from me.
No.
Because I'm a believer.
No.
I believe, however, that God, too, shares a measure of responsibility, not for killing, obviously.
No.
But his responsibility is and was that he gave us the freedom to decide. He gambled on us, in a sense. When he gifted to human species with free will, he gambled on us, and in this instance, he lost. So in that sense, God, too, is a participant. The book of Genesis says at one moment, when he looks at the violence of humanity, he says, in effect, I'm sorry that I've created it.
Yeah, well, we're applying human terms here, I should think, in the sense that the human terms, we don't know the mind of God, huh? But the fact having given the gift was a beautiful gift, because I was thinking the other day when we had the daylight saving time change around, time next to grace is God's greatest gift. With that time, you can purchase eternity. In other words, those might say who have the like, otherwise, one more hour of life would be a tremendous thing for them to have. But in other words, God gave you that gift, that's true, huh? But to be used correctly. Now we say, for instance, when we talk about sin, that's not the use of will, it's free will, it's the abuse of it, you follow? And free will is given that you make good or better. Huh? In other words, like free will, I may go to New York with different ways of doing it, you follow? But if I choose to abuse it, as I mentioned in the this afternoon in the chaplain, the accumulation in our mind, when these come to our mind, if we don't change it, we're responsible for it.
Well, I agree with you on the final conclusion.
Yeah, very good. Yes.
Along those lines, I think having you gentlemen here, I would like to present the following question. We're all aware of the final solution that was almost successful, that Hitler tried to implement. I'd like you to address the question of the origin of the final solution. Do you think it has a theological origin as far as the Christ killing and the Jew being responsible for Christ? I would like to address the theological origin.
What do you mean by final solution? What is your understanding of such?
The final solution of the getting rid of the Jew.
The Germans called it the final solution.
I want to get your depth of...
Yeah, that's really as simply as I can put it. The Jew is to be eliminated. That was the basic premise of the objective of the final solution.
Well, I would answer, because when they ask the question, what is the greatest commandment of God? If we all believe in the Ten Commandments, the book of Exodus, as the chaplain tells us, the fact that verse 12, they say the greatest commandment is love God, love your neighbor. So love your neighbor. So if that first law, that second part of the first commandment were adhered to, there'd be no need for any other laws at all. Huh? So the final solution cannot be rid of anybody, because we're all human beings. Huh? We're all God's children. Because we come from God, we're going back to God. And on the way through, however, we go back to a question of free will. So it isn't a question of getting rid of anybody. In fact, two wrongs don't make a right. So therefore, the fact that the final solution cannot be the mercy of anyone, but God is, once again, patient and gives us a second chance. So I would say that I would answer that there is no final solution other than the fact that God wants everyone to achieve their salvation.
Do you see a theological basis for that final solution having been attempted?
Why Hitler would do it, you mean?
Yeah.
Well, no, because after, once again, as I mentioned before, there are so many more vices than virtues, huh? And the mad mind, say, of Hitler is such, huh? But again, a man can conjure up in his mind many, many way more ways of committing sin or vices than it might say adherence to virtue. So I say, well, I can enumerate the virtues, the principal natural virtues, the cardinal virtues of that type, prudence, justice, temperance, and fortitude and such. But then the man can find many, many devious ways of violating that. Huh? So again, I would adhere very definitely to the fact that we have a free will, and God has given us the grace to do it, and there's no reason why you cannot if you follow that aspect.
Rabbi, would you have any...
Well, I think I know what you're driving at. You want to know were the German people prepared to accept Hitler's guidance and challenge with regard to the Jews, the extermination of the Jews? Were they prepared for this vicious expression of hatred by a centuries-old dislike of the Jews, which was preached certainly in the medieval church. Most scholars would believe that this was a contributing factor. But on the other hand, the guilt was certainly not the church's. But it was, I think, anti-Semitism to a degree is an endemic disease, and it is the responsibility of religious institutions to eliminate it. And I do also, look, I grew up in Germany. I grew up with students and teachers around me who were taught from childhood on that Jews were inferior and that whatever punishment would come to them for the killing of Christ, they deserved. Now, not everybody in my class believed it, but I'm sorry to say enough of my teachers and fellow students believed it to make my childhood in school very uncomfortable. In my book, my recent autobiography there, I tell of a fellow by the name of Schultz, who sat in front of me for 6 or 7 years throughout high school, German high school lasting 9 years in those days. When the big break, coffee break came, breakfast break, second breakfast came in the morning at 10:20. Schultz, being a rather big fellow, would turn around as soon as the teacher had left the room, hit me squarely across the face, and I says, "That's yours for today, you shitty Jew. Scheiß Jude."
Scheiß Jude, shitty Jew, right.
One day, Schultz was sick. He was absent. Came the bell. I stood up to receive my blow. You know, in a masochistic way, I almost missed it. You know? But he was next. He was back the next day. Now, other students would stand around. Nobody ever interfered on my behalf.
You can't defend indefensible. I mean, in other words, my point is, the fact is this, that we have the goal, we have to set the destiny, and we have the means whereby provided that we adhere to it.
So we're talking about a need for education now.
Oh, very much so, yeah.
Within the churches and community centers and schools and so forth. Yes, Mr.
In James Michener's book, The Source, throughout the whole book, there runs a common theme, of course, that Jews are God's chosen people. And in this book, he more or less weaves a tale that the Jews believe this to a fault. In other words, he called them stiff-necked and so forth.
God calls them stiff-necked.
Well,
stiff-necked people.
So did James Michener. And I believe that down through recorded history, the things that have happened to the Jews may have been brought on them to change their ways somewhat. Now that might be a little off the wall.
Well, I'd like to think it is.
I'll let the rabbi address.
Well, no, I don't really think you would contemplate the implication of what you said.
No.
In the sense that ultimately, you know, the fate of the Jews' fault. You know, it's not that simple.
No.
But look. We are not a perfect people. We're just human beings, and ultimately, we are all responsible for the civilization in which we live. That's both the criminal and the victim. We all have a share in it. Unfortunately, even little children are otherwise quite innocent, are involved in the sins of their fathers. But I'd like to think that the enormity of the Holocaust is, I think, a failure of modern civilization.
Yeah.
The worship of technology, the worship of race, the unbridled ambition, which found a visible victim, which were my people. And if anything, a conference like this should bring to mind the necessity of rehearsing the facts which did take place as a warning that human beings are capable not only of the best,
right,
but also of the worst. Or maybe, more optimistically, I should put it around. They're capable of the worst, but they're also capable of the best.
I don't think we could add too much more to that statement. Now, it's a very fitting closing to this type of an interview. And I do want to thank you, gentlemen, for participating.
Perfectly well.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
All set. Perfect.